I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. We come your way every Friday afternoon on this radio station and syndicated on some other stations around the country. It's very, very cool. Co-op is a community radio station that's solar-powered, cooperatively run, all volunteer. My engineer and co-conspirator is Tracy Schultz. Tracy's back with us. Tracy.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you so much.
How are you doing? It's been a little wet.
Yeah, a little wet outside. We're doing all right, though.
We had some flash floods last night, this morning.
Yeah.
And a massive, massive rainfall. 8 inches, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I live at the top of a hill, so I wasn't worried, but my dog was very concerned. We want to thank Alan Campbell, who helped us out the last couple of weeks. The old master, Alan. I say the old master, being older, substantially older than Alan, but I don't know. All right. There's a whole lot to. This is going to be a fun show, folks. Vietnam vet and aviation historian Thomas McKelvey Cleaver is the author of the best-selling military history, The Bridge Busters, The True Story of the Catch-22 Bomb Wing, published by is it Regnery, Tom?
Yes.
Regnery History.
Which is very funny.
And I sort of saw some stuff that made me think it may be funny. Anyway, Thomas is a native Texan, a journalist, and a produced screenwriter. He has written successful horror movies and articles about Second World War aviation, was a major fundraiser for Barack Obama, and has been an activist on anti-war political reform and environmental issues for almost 50 years. And I might mention that he was previously our guest on Rag Radio in 2008, when on the 50th anniversary, on its 50th anniversary, Tom provided firsthand history about the Tonkin Gulf incident that was used as a pretense for starting the war in Vietnam. And that was a fascinating discussion. And he also wrote an article for the Rag Blog about the same subject. He had a lot of firsthand and secondhand history that he recounted there. In Bridge Busters, Tom believes he has found the artist in the work. One bombardier in the 57th Bomb Wing that flew out of Corsica during World War II and bombed vital bridges throughout Italy to sabotage German supply routes was a young New Yorker named Joseph Heller, who would later turn his experience into the classic 1961 war novel Catch-22. Tom contends that there is a direct connection between Joseph Heller's life experiences during the war and his decision to write the novel. He says there's strong circumstantial evidence that Heller said yes to the deal his alter ego, Yossarian, said no to, and that he came to see that as a moral failure. As a writer, he was able to create an alternative universe where the correct decision was made. Tom is the author of the Fabled 15, The Pacific War Saga of Carrier Air Group 15, and The Frozen Chosen, His Critical History of the First Year of the Korean War, will be published in July. Okay, all right, before welcome to Rag Radio once more, Tom.
Yeah, glad to be there.
My longtime friend. Before we get into talking about the book and Heller and all the connections and your vivid, vivid way of telling the story of war based upon your amazing research, and I want to talk about that and how you researched the book. I think we should take a moment for a little bit of theater. Okay? Everybody ready? All right. Is Orr crazy?
Of course he is. He has to be crazy to keep flying after all the close calls he's had.
Well, why can't you ground him?
I can, but first he has to ask me.
That's all he's got to do to be grounded?
That's all.
Then you can ground him.
No, then I cannot ground him.
Ah.
There's a catch.
A catch?
Sure, catch 22. Anyone who wants to get out of combat isn't really crazy, so I can't ground him.
Okay, yeah, let me see if I got this straight. In order to be grounded, I've got to be crazy. And I must be crazy to keep flying. But if I ask to be grounded, that means I'm not crazy anymore, and I have to keep flying.
You got it. That's catch 22.
Whoo! That's some catch, that catch 22.
It's the best there is.
Okay. That's Yossarian and Doc Danica. And that's from the screenplay, Buck Henry's screenplay from the novel by Joseph Heller. And I don't know if that's the exact way it went down in the novel. I don't remember, but
it actually is.
I was thinking it sounded pretty close.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. I was just looking at a few things in Catch 22, and there's a couple of things where Heller writes that it's very very interesting as to what Catch 22 is. There's a section in where he goes to Rome, where Yossarian goes to Rome to find Neely's girlfriend, and all of the people are gone, and he walks in and he said, did they arrest them? They chased them away. They just chased them away. Then why did they do it if they didn't arrest them? I don't know. Who will take care of me? Who will take care of me now that all the poor young girls are gone? Who will take care of me? There must have been a reason. They couldn't just barge in here and chase everyone out. No reason. What right did they have? Catch 22. What? Yossarian froze in his tracks with fear and alarm and felt his whole body begin to tingle. What did you say? Catch 22. Catch 22. Catch 22 says they have a right to do anything we can't stop them from doing. What the hell are you talking about? How do you know it was Catch 22? Who told you it was Catch 22? The soldiers with the hard white hats and clubs. The girls were crying. Did we do anything wrong? They said, the men said no and pushed them out the door with the end of their clubs. Then why are you chasing us out? Catch 22, the men said. What right do you have? Catch 22, the men said. All I kept saying was Catch 22, Catch 22. What does it mean, Catch 22? What is Catch 22? Didn't they show it to you, Yossarian demanded? Didn't you even make them read it? They don't have to show us Catch 22. The law says they don't have to. What law says they don't have to? Catch 22.
What, you know, it's just, he's so hit on something there. It's such a, I mean, that concept and that terminology just sort of stormed into the English language.
Everybody understood it. Very funny. I had a friend of mine who got my book just recently, and he decided that he would read the novel before he read my book because he'd last read it when he was in high school and he didn't like it. And so he did read it, and he posted in a review of my book. He said, I went back and read it, and after 24 years in the education establishment, Catch 22 is my new favorite novel.
Well, you pointed out that we all have a Catch 22. One of the reasons we relate to it is that we all have a Catch 22 in our lives.
Yeah.
And you had one in yours.
Yeah. Back in the 70s when I worked in government, I finally got to, I was getting more and more progressively unhappy with what was going on. And I finally ended up one week having an argument with my then boss, who was a person who I had really did not want to have for a boss, and had law, and my the boss I liked was gone, and we were stuck with this guy who was a thoroughgoing incompetent, and we were arguing, you know, that this was, here was something we were supposed to do, and this is the way to do it right, and he was sitting there, no, that violates the rules. And we went back and forth and back and forth, and no, that violates the rules. You can't do that, even if it is the right thing. And I went home that weekend, and I was very discouraged. And I sat there and did a lot of thinking about it. And I suddenly concluded that this was what I'd been upset about. I'd been doing this for several years, trying to do the right thing, fighting the system that said, no, the rules are that you can't do the right thing. And I ended up quitting. I sat there that Sunday afternoon and said, I'm going to quit. And I wrote a 37-page letter of resignation, which when I finished it, I said, no, you can't turn this in. And I went to the office the next day, and I wrote two sentences. I am resigning effective April 30th, and I'd like to thank everyone I've been working with for what they've taught me. And I left, and essentially I was like Yossarian. I was paddling in a boat to Sweden from Corsica. I really didn't actually know what I was going to do, but I did know that I wasn't going to do that anymore. And it yeah. ended up okay. with, I'm doing what I'm what I do now.
Okay, it's such an incredible concept.
It is, and you get so, you get to the point where what you have. I mean, my friend had the done 24 years in education, had resigned, had finally retired. He retired on time. He, instead of waiting until he was 65, he as soon as it was chance, because the system had gotten to, has gotten to the point in education, as he said, I can't teach anymore. I can't do what I want to do of educating. I can teach them how to take tests, but I can't educate them.
Okay. All right. Bruce Davison, editor of Flight Journal, wrote, one of Tom Cleaver's trademarks is that he somehow manages to weave mechanical facts into the fabric of a thoroughly human tale in such a way that you come away feeling as if you've just watched a wildly detailed movie. In The Bridge Busters, you can almost smell the engine exhaust and hear the empty 50 caliber casings clatter to the fuselage floor under the gunner's feet. He makes the truth read like well-done fiction. Well, that's nice.
Oh, it is. That's what I try to do. It's very interesting. Everybody I've done. The one nice thing about Regnery, as opposed to some of the other publishers I've dealt with, is they believe in selling the book once they've got it published. So I've been doing a bunch of interviews and with places that I never expected to be talking to, but it's been very interesting. And they and every one of the people that I that interviewed who's read the book said, you know, I felt like I was on the mission, and that's what I was aiming for. I think that comes from being a, you know, I've been a screenwriter, I've been a writer of dramatic fiction, and plus I've flown myself, so I put all that together, and I say, this is how I would feel if I was in there.
Okay, tell me how, I think it's fascinating the way, tell us how you decided to do this, and then tell us a little bit, without going into too much detail, because we've got a lot of ground to cover, how you researched it. You okay. came across a treasure trove.
It started off, for the last 20 years, I've contributed to Flight Journal, and what we've been doing is finding the stories that haven't been told and getting them into the record so that they're there for others later. And On Veterans Day, back in 2013, I was reading an article in the Huffington Post by a woman who was writing about the fact that her father had fought in World War II and had never, in all the years since, ever talked about what he'd done, despite her many questions. And that summer, she had been helping him clean out his house, and she found a box with a bunch of papers in it, and she went through the papers, and here was a paper that had the name of the organization that he'd been in the Air Force, and she looked it up and did some Googling and discovered that they had a Veterans Association and that they were going to have a convention 6 weeks later 150 miles away from where they live, and she convinced her dad to go to it with her, and she said, and now he can't stop talking. And when I read that, I thought to myself, this is some stories that haven't been told before. And it was I was fortunately able to track her down on the internet and get an email address. I wrote her, told her who I was and what I was doing. She put me in touch with her father, Paul Young, and he had flown 45 missions with these guys. His first mission was the first mission of the Brenner Pass campaign, and his last mission was the last mission of the war. And talking to him and listening to him about what he was willing to talk to me, because he knew that I had been to war also and had some understanding, and it was no wonder nobody wanted to talk about it. It was basically 45 charges of the Light Brigade, the mission, the way they flew the missions, and I ended up writing an article about him and using that as a general history of the group, and everybody liked it pretty much. And then I got a And then later that next year in 2014, I got represented by Jim Hornfisher, who lives down there in Austin. It's nice to have an agent who's also a history writer who I respect, which is pretty cool. And he was sitting there telling me, asking me, well, what do you got that we can go with? And I went to my bag of stories, and he was going, yeah, it's interesting, And then I said, well, there is the true story of the group that Joe Heller flew with in World War II. And he went, okay. So I ended up writing a proposal, which was promptly turned down everywhere, but except for where it was picked up, where Alex Novak said, "Yeah," and
which I think you point out that's the problem. You say that everybody turns it down. Everybody says no until someone says yes.
That's exactly what happens. I mean, Jim was apologizing to me that he said, and I was going, "This is the way it goes." I said, 30 years in Hollywood, I know how this works.
Okay, we've just got a couple of minutes before we take a break, but let's get started here. First, I want you to tell us about the mission, about the 57th Bomb Wing and its importance. I know you said it was the most successful battlefield interdiction campaign ever carried out by the Air Force, and yet it's largely unknown today. So I want you to tell us a little bit about that, and then tell us Joe Heller's actual role, and then how you see that he actually used that his experience there to write the book.
Okay.
I'm going to break you in about 2 minutes.
The quick and easy thing to say about the 57th bombing is they won the war in Italy. By the end of October in 1944, the Allied armies in northern Italy had fought themselves out trying to break through the German defenses in the Alps, the Gothic line, and couldn't do it. And on the 1st of November, the German quartermaster general wrote that for the army group that they were getting 600% of the supplies they needed, arriving every 30 minutes on trains that took 8 hours to drive to go from Munich to Bologna through the Brenner Pass. And he said, as long as that continues, we can hold out indefinitely. A week after he wrote that, the bombers flew their first mission. They knocked out the transformers because it was an electric train that was going through the pass, which forced the Germans to bring coal-fired trains from elsewhere. They continued to fly the missions for the next 6 months through the coldest winter in Europe in 100 years. And they had to keep going back to places because once they bombed it, they had to keep it bombed so that the Germans were trying to build it back up. The end of March of 45, the German quartermaster general made a report that they were getting 2,400 tons of supplies, 40% of what they needed, and that the railroad was closed over half the time the month previously, and that they were stuck. 9 days later, the Allied armies started their final offensive after the snow melted. And 20 days after that, the German general who'd fought them from Salerno to Bologna surrendered a week and a half ahead of everybody else.
Okay, doesn't that tell us something? And after this, we're going to need to take a break. But doesn't that tell us something about the absurdity of war? Bomb the bridge. The Germans start building it back up. You bomb it again. They start building it back up.
Right.
It tells us something about the nature of war. We'll come back in just a second because there's a lot of stories to tell. Let's talk about at Heller. And then there's all kinds of other things that you suggested and things that I've came up with from looking at, to the extent that I was able to actually go through the book because I did it with a PDF.
Okay.
But first, Tracy Schultz, it's time to take a break.
Thank you.
Okay, Tracy Schultz, what were we listening to there?
Oh, that was a classic Glenn Miller track, American Patrol, as suggested by our guest today.
Our guest suggested that?
Yeah. Yeah,
well, he's pretty clever. Tom Cleaver.
World War II definitely had the best soundtrack.
There was some great music.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Just a quick aside. Uh-huh. The bands that were there, what they did during the war, Artie Shaw was brilliant. He went out to the Pacific in the Navy, and when he went out there, he told them, just in case we get in places where there's trouble, train us so we can do something. And the band got trained in firefighting. They ended up on a carrier just as they were about to start performing for the guys. There was a kamikaze attack, and the carrier was hit. And Artie Shaw and his band joined in fighting the fire and saving the ship. They told him they wanted to give him a Navy Cross for it, and he said, why don't you give it to somebody who's really fighting the war?
Wow. I didn't catch that.
Great story. Okay. Joseph Heller, you said that when questioned about his wartime service, Heller said, I flew mostly milk runs. But that was not entirely true, was it?
No. The fortunate thing for my research on this book was that the children and grandchildren of the guys have worked, and they have a website, and they have all the records up there of the wing from when it was formed till the end of the war, and it's a searchable database. And you go in there and you put in, and you can go in there and you can find any mission. You can find out what airplanes flew it, who was on which airplane, and what was and a lot of commentary about what the purpose of the mission was, things like, and the results and things like that. And if you search on Joe Heller, you find that he arrives on Corsica 2 days after the German bombing raid that he ends up using in the novel as Milo Minderbinder's bombing of the group, and then 2 weeks later he flew his first mission, the end of May 1944. By the 23rd of August, he'd flown 38 missions, and 35 of them, if you read the records, were hot missions. They were not milk runs. They were the kind of missions that were, quote unquote, all up inside my flak helmet, as they used to say about how scared they would get. And then between the 24th of August of 44 and the end of January of 45, when he goes home, he flies 20 missions. He'd been flying a mission every other day, and he flies 20 missions over 6 months, a mission a week on average. And only one of them, at the beginning of that period of time, is hot. The mission to sink the Italian cruiser Taranto in La Spezia Harbor, which, interestingly enough, is mentioned in the novel, that specific mission. But he disappears. And what happened? Well, as I'm doing my research, by chance I was able to find. A woman who was writing a novel about her father being in the group, and she told me about somebody else she'd met, and I got to know Burton Bloom, who lives over in Thailand now. He's a businessman, but his father, Wilbur Bloom, was a documentary filmmaker before the war, became a bombardier, was in the same group with Heller, and the group commander put him in charge of a special unit that would make documentaries about things the group were doing. The group commander was using it to show his superiors all the good things that they were doing to feather his own nest. And at the end of August of 44, he got an assignment to do a documentary called Training in Combat, which was about replacement air crews coming to the group, getting training before they flew operational missions. And in his diary, Lieutenant Bloom said, this is the colonel's boondoggle. And there's about 40 minutes of the film still in existence, been reassembled at the National Archives. Burton Bloom had found 400 4x5 negatives that his father had when his father died. He was cleaning out his storage and found these. And It's all stuff from the film. And guess who's in the movie? Joseph Heller.
This was when he did Cal Runs.
And interesting, before this, there was supposed to be no photographs that had been taken of Heller during the war. He always said, nobody took any pictures of me. Well, here's this whole 40 minutes of film, and he's in about half of it. And the movie was made between the middle of September and the middle of December, and he's in it. And during that time, this is when things started to get hot with the Brenner Pass campaign. And in the war diaries, there's mention of milk runs are hard to find, and yet he flew 19 milk runs. And then when he left, he had 60 missions. And he left at a time when 70 was the absolute number, and nobody was getting away on less. You look at that and you go, okay, so what happened in August? Because there's this big change. Well, I looked through the records, and there's a mission. So the bombing of the Satima Bridge at the town of Ponte San Martino on August 24th, The lead bombardier of that mission, later, in 60 years later, 10 years ago, told Roger Jugler, who's an Italian historian I met, that this was the mission that bothered him and the most, and that he'd thought about ever since. And Joe Heller was on that mission. He was flying the wing of the lead bombardier's airplane, so he was right there. Ponte San Martino is a town of about 2,500 people. It had no military importance whatsoever other than its location. The bridge had been built by Caesar's legionnaires on their way to invade Gaul back in 55 BC. Napoleon went across it on his way to Marengo in 1800. And the town was there because people in the region could get to a market by coming across the bridge. That's all it was. And their job was to knock it down, to turn the town into rubble, to block, as they said afterwards, to block the advance of a German armored division to the front. This is a mission that they'd done before, and it was the mission that everybody hated.
So is this...
Because they had to go up and blow up an innocent town. And the thing is, if you're doing it over Germany at 25,000 feet, you can't see it like the guys that were doing that. But these guys were doing it from 5,000 feet, and you can see it.
So this
is what's happening below.
This, and you think, was
on that,
the...
And on that mission, there were 240 people were killed, including 40 children who were in the elementary school that was hit by the bombs. The 18 planes came in, and as they were on their final run, one of the airplanes broke formation, lifted up and dropped their bombs in an open field. When they got back to Corsica, the pilot said that he had evaded flak. Well, number one, there wasn't a gun in the town, so there was no flak. Number two, it wouldn't matter if there were 100 guns in the town. It was a court-martial offense to break the formation once you were on the final run, and he did. And nobody in his crew contradicted him, and nobody on the mission contradicted him of what he said. And at that point, Heller gets his change. In the 2 weeks before that mission, there had been a whole lot of problems going on in the group. They weren't getting replacements, and they were getting their missions increased. They went from 50 missions on the 1st of August to 55 a week later to 60 a week after that. And on the 20th, 4 days before that mission, three officers and two enlisted men said, we've flown 50 missions. We aren't going to fly anymore. And we don't have blame. The two enlisted men got thrown in the stockade. The three officers got put in hack, which meant that they had to stay in their tents other than to go eat. And there isn't a record of who the three officers were, but there's a good possibility that one of them was Joe Heller. And the war diarist talks about the fact that there was all kinds of hassle before that, before that mission, there was no comment about what they were doing. All the record of what they, of why they did it, is written ex post facto. And at the same time, they were getting a lot of looks from the 12th Air Force headquarters. The commanding general of 12th Air Force contradicted the wing commander and said, you know, that the guys, get the guys out of the stockade, and they actually made certain that they got enough enough replacements by the end of the month that people could go home again. That was what was really happening with the increase of missions every once in a while, was that they were in a secondary war after the invasion of Normandy, where the main war was up in France and Germany, and they didn't get replacements. At one point, they had 22 crews ready to go home, qualified to go home, and they had 10 replacements. They had to increase the missions so that they stayed there. But Heller was in that, and so in the novel, you find at the end of chapter 29, you find Major Danby giving this talk, briefing the mission about why are we going to bomb this town that has no military value, and they're going to turn it into rubble, and it's going to block a German armored division, and everybody is arguing that they don't have to do it, they shouldn't have to do it, and Colonel Korn comes in and he hears them, and he says, you know, the general and us, we go out of our way to find milk runs for you guys like this. But if you don't want to have them, you know, we don't have to. We can send you to Bologna. You just let me know anytime. And there's dead silence in the room. As what's happening is that they're sitting there considering to themselves, you know, do I go bomb a village of people I've never seen before and be safe, or do I go on a mission where there's a good chance I might get shot down? The moral quandary.
So, and you think this is what Heller did not say? What Heller said yes to, that Yossarian said no to?
Yeah, you know, and in the novel, Yossarian is the lead bombardier, and his friend Dunbar goes out and breaks formation and drops his bombs, just like really happened in the movie. It's the mission where they end up dropping all their bombs in the ocean, which was visually a more visual thing. And then afterwards, Yossarian starts becoming, you know, very opposed to them. He says, "I won't fly anymore. I've flown all the missions. I'm not going to fly, you know, a 71st mission." And they bring him in and they say, "You know, like us. Be our pal. We'll take care of you.
Yeah.
We'll send you home.
Yeah.
All you got to do is just say nice things about us." And Yossarian says yes to it. And then he steps out and he gets stabbed in the back, which is in the movie and in the novel. And afterwards, he says no to it. And that's when, and they're going to court martial him, and that's when he goes off and gets in the boat and starts paddling to Sweden.
And so you think that that's, so you believe that by seeing the real, by uncovering the real history there and Heller's role, that you believe that this, that he sort of explained here, he dealt with this moral quandary in this fashion.
The thing is that he suddenly wasn't flying dangerous missions at a time when it was hard to do that, and he leaves early. And there's a whole commentary in a scene towards the end of the novel where people are asking him about, you know, asking Yossarian about, you know, are you not going to fly? Does that mean we're going to fly your missions? Is that fair? All of that, and that's the stuff that Heller was thinking about. I got off, and other guys didn't. And you know, what does that say about me? And you know, a couple of people have commented that, you know, who I know who knew him over the years, that, you know, he's this Jewish kid from Brooklyn who grew up in the 30s with a socially active family, and you know, he had a strong moral sense. Buck Henry said he was the angriest guy I ever knew. He judged everything by a very strong moral code on himself and everybody else. So that's the kind of person who would look at that later and say, you know, that's not good. There's a real nice little quote. Let me get it here. The chaplain Taplin talks about in the chaplain had sinned and it was good. Common sense told him that telling lies and defecting from duty were sins. On the other hand, everyone knew that sin was evil and that no good could come from evil. But he did feel good. He felt positively marvelous. Consequently, it followed logically that telling lies and defecting from duty could not be sins. The chaplain had mastered, in a moment of divine intuition, the handy technique of protective rationalization, and he was exhilarated by his discovery. It was miraculous. It was almost no trick at all, he saw, to turn vice into virtue and slander into truth, impotence into abstinence, arrogance into humility, plunder into philanthropy, thievery into honor, blasphemy into wisdom, brutality into patriotism, and sadism into justice. Anybody could do it. It required no brains at all. It merely required no character.
Okay. All right. Okay, we need to take a break, and this is a good time to do it. I want to tell people Tom Cleaver, who's my guest, is the author of Catch-22, or the Bridge Busters, the true story of the Catch-22 bomb wing. This is a fascinating discussion, Tom. We'll be right back.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a tootie, a tootie blows it into the blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes a company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was a boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B.
All right, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We're talking with Thomas McKelvey Cleaver, who is an aviation historian, a Vietnam veteran, a journalist, a produced screenwriter, and an activist who we've known for a long time. And the book, again, is The Bridge Busters, The True Story of the Catch-22 Bomb Wing. And we don't have time to really go into it, unfortunately, but he tells, Tom, you tell the stories, I mean, with just vivid, impactful language, and it makes you feel like you're there, and some of it's pretty scary stuff. So tell me about the role of the Italian resistance.
The Italian resistance, it's a story that, you know, almost nobody knows over here, but after the Italian surrender, the left parties, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, that had been driven underground by the fascists, became active, and they had groups of guerrillas. The term Maquis, which was used to talk about the French guerrilla, the French resistance, that's actually a term for the tough brush on the island of Corsica. And the island of Corsica was self-liberated, mostly self-liberated. It ended up with the Corsicans and Italian soldiers fighting German soldiers in 1943, with French troops coming in to liberate the island. But the term was used for all of these groups in northern Italy. They're doing these bombing missions in the Apennines, which is part of the Alps. I mean, they're going, these mountains, you know, they're the Alps, 8,000 feet high, tough, rugged countryside. But the thing is that the Italian people were working, wanted to see the Allies win. You had people, the Italian fascists and the Germans made it very clear that if you decided to resist, that you were going to pay a price if you got caught. The price for hiding an Allied airman was was shooting the entire family and burning their home. So you put people put up a lot to do that, and I found the one story about the bombing mission near a town, and the plane was shot down, and the guys bailed out, and they ended up with people who took them and hid them, and they were hidden in that town for 3 months. Everybody in the town knew they were there in the one house, and nobody told anybody.
There was the one story about the guy who parachutes into the field, and the man comes out and gives him clothing, doesn't even want his family to see what's happening because they could sort of
right
I guess this was a very common thing. This happened a whole lot.
Yeah, it happened. It happened a lot. The British ended up dropping in special commandos who organized and worked with the resistance, and they eventually ended up they would gather the guys together and get 50 or 60 guys protected and then get the Air Force to fly in a C-47 into an open field and pick them up and take them out.
Okay, how was it that Catch-22, and I think this surprised Heller himself, became so associated with the Vietnam War?
That's because of the nature. It's funny because the story is about the war in Italy, but what happened was the only people who wanted to fight in Italy were the English. Because Churchill was deathly afraid throughout the war of ending up with another Western Front in France like World War One. He knew the British couldn't do it again, and so they, in the summer of 43, they invaded Sicily and they had regained control of the sea lanes in the Mediterranean. They could get to the Suez Canal and things like that, and the American military was ready to just pull out and get everything ready in England to go invade France the next year, and the British made the argument: do you really want to leave the Germans a year of no fighting? We can't do that. We've got to do something. And besides, the Italians might surrender. And so they did invade Italy. But for the Americans, it was not a high priority. And the leaders and the American leadership was pretty second rate, other than Lucian Truscott, who eventually became the commander down there and eventually won. But Mark Clark, who was quite famous, when they finally broke through at the Battle of Cassino in the spring of 44, the guys on Corsica were fighting. When they finally broke through, and there was a chance that the American army was going to link up with the British army, and they could catch the Germans and have a German surrender that would have ended the war. And Mark Clark diverted the American forces to liberate Rome, which was an open city. The Germans had evacuated. They were not going to fight in Rome. And the Americans are marching through liberating Rome while the German army is going around it, being chased by the Canadians and the British. And and 2 days later, the Normandy invasion happened, and the Americans really didn't care about it. So by the time that Heller started flying them there, a week after his first mission, the war in Italy became a war that was being fought because it was there. There was a strong feeling that it wasn't a higher purpose. I've talked to a member of the guys, and they said, we never really used to talk about it, but you did notice that there wasn't much news about us in Stars and Stripes. And it was all about what was going on in France. So they had a feeling that, of what was important and what wasn't. And Heller had that. So he writes a story about there is no higher purpose to what they're doing. They're getting in the bombers, they're flying missions, they're dropping bombs on bridges and towns and coming back and putting up with it. And that's really the experience that these guys had on the island. Sterling Ditchie, who was one of the guys in the story, told me after he started reading the book, he said, "I didn't know all this stuff was going on around us that you've written about in here." and that was true. But they had a feeling that it was not such a high priority, not such a high purpose to what they were doing, and that's what Vietnam was.
So it actually, Catch-22 became really an anti-war novel.
Yeah, I've never actually run across a pro-war novel.
Well, anybody who really talks about war,
who's ever been to war.
Yeah, right. And you've been to war.
Yeah, it changes your mind.
It changes a lot, doesn't it? Most of the people that I knew in the anti-war, or the people who were a lot of the leaders in the anti-war movement, and this surprises some of the right-wingers, were actually people who came back from the war and fought against it. So Vietnam veterans led the anti-war movement in many ways. So, What differences are there between the story that the novel tells and the real history of the group that Heller flew with?
Well, the difference in characters, to me, the really big difference is the wing commander. General Robert Knapp was the polar opposite of General Dreidel, the character in the novel. Robert Knapp first started flying at age 20. In World War One, he had been flying longer than most of the people that were in his unit had been alive. In the 20s and 30s, he was one of the guys who stayed in and worked to build an air force. And then in 1940, when the B-25 was new and just coming in, he started training. He was started putting put in charge of training men to fly it. He ended up training the guys who became the Doolittle Raiders. And went on to train the six B-25 groups, three that went to the Mediterranean and three that went to the Pacific. And when the ones in the Mediterranean were ready to go, he said, I want to lead one of these groups. I've trained them. And they said to him, no, you're 44 years old. You're too old. You can't go. He ended up going directly to his old friend Hap Arnold, who was the leader of the entire Air Force, and got him to okay it. And he took the group to North Africa, and as group commander, he flew 44 of the toughest missions. The tough mission came up. He was there. He led from in front. The guys who knew him then loved him. He was quote unquote hard but fair, and people like that in a combat leader. And then at the end of at the very beginning in 1944, he got promoted to brigadier general. He got put in charge of the entire wing. So when Heller got there, all he knew was this distant character who showed up and and ran inspections and gave out awards and was probably the guy who kept changing the mission totals, which he was. But generals don't go tell first lieutenants why they're doing it, and the reason they did it was they weren't getting any replacements. But he was the guy. The whole thing with Milo Minderbinder, he was a character that was based on, he was a creation, but they had guys. The one thing that they had was they were living in tents on Corsica, and sunny Italy wasn't very sunny. It was actually pretty cold most of the time there. And they were living under tough conditions. The first 6 months they were there, they note in the war diary in October of 44 that we finally completed the showers and we have hot showers for the first time since we've been here. As a big deal. They talk about, we finally got a really good latrine system. That's how primitive the life was that they were living. Yeah. Well, the General Knapp kind of knew that, as Napoleon put it, an army marches on its stomach. Well, when guys went on leave any place, they took one of the old airplanes and they'd fly to Cairo, Sterling Ditchy City, saw every place in the Mediterranean eventually, and when they went, they took money from the crew's recreation funds, and they bought booze and good food and eggs, and they were expected to bring back an airplane full of food. And if they got in trouble with what they were doing, they had a phone number that they were to give the authorities, and it was General Knapp's phone number, and he would vouch that they were doing what he had ordered them to do. and at one point, Jerry Rosenberg told me about this this kid who arrived in January of 45 as a private, And they found out that his older brother was the Navy officer in charge of the Naples supply depot. And this kid was within a week promoted to master sergeant and given a job that involved going to Naples twice a week, where he talked to his brother and his brother gave him food.
Okay. All right, we don't have a whole lot of time left. Yeah. Quickly, tell us the story of Dan Bowling.
Dan Bowling is just an amazing guy. He was Paul Young said he was the squadron leader, which is different from being the squadron commander. He was the son of a miner in Bisbee, Arizona. His father was a socialist union organizer and later a member of the Arizona legislature on the socialist ticket. And he was a tough kid. As he said, growing up that way, he had to learn to fight early. And he was somebody he to this day is a guy who does not take guff from anybody. And he got in there, and he found out that one of the officers that he trained with and he considered a friend for most of the time after the war, he found out that the guy had been military intelligence and was there to check him because they figured he must be a subversive because of his father's background.
Well, certainly.
And yet he was at what he did. There's this whole thing through the novel. They talk about this, and in the movie they talk about, and it was real, was that they were always worried about getting good pictures of a bomb drop because they were using dumb bombs. The only way they could hit the target was to get into a nice close concentration. Well, that was supposed to involve these long straight bombing runs, which gave the Germans plenty of time to shoot people. And he decided that that wasn't the way things should be. So he and his bombardier worked out how to put coordinates into the bomb site so that they could fly evasive action on their way into the target, and they only had to fly straight and level for 45 seconds before they dropped. And as he said, my missions were the most successful in terms of what we achieved, and we had no casualties. And that was what he was proudest of. And when the colonel would get up and tell them at briefing that I want to see 5-minute straight and level bombing runs because I expect to get a star out of this, afterwards he'd tell the guys, do what I do, follow me.
Okay.
And he was the best. He was the best one. He came. And the interesting thing about him is he also, it reminds us that, you know, these guys went off and they saved the world, but they also came back and created the world that we all lived in. He came back and decided to get into construction because a cousin of his new wife was had been a CB, and they were, and so they thought they would get into construction. He ended up building his company, built about a third of the houses in Torrance here, and about a fourth of the houses on Palos Verdes Peninsula, and he did it because he went in and he did GI Bill housing because he said people need housing, and I spent the war knocking houses down. I'm going to spend the life building houses up.
All right. Okay, Tom, how did you get interested? You've also been a pilot, even though you weren't a pilot in the military. And how did you get so interested in aviation and in aviation history?
That's a really good. My mother says that the very first word I ever said was O-plane when a P-38 flew over the park we were in when I was a year old. My dad was involved in aviation in the 30s. He worked for a year for Roscoe Turner, the air racer. And I recently discovered that I wasn't as crazy as I thought through most of my life. I was a person with Asperger's. And Aspergians are, but we, if we are interested in something, we can become really interested to the point where we look crazy to people who aren't interested in it. And I just had this lifelong interest in airplanes, and I don't know why, but I did.
Well, I have, several colleagues who have Asperger's, and it seems like some of the most creative and intelligent people out there.
Asperger's has a very, there's a very close correlation to Asperger's and creativity. In fact, I don't know a writer who I know well enough to know who I wouldn't say, you certainly look like you're doing it some of the time.
Yeah, and ADD has a lot of the same characteristics in terms
of... Well, with Asperger's, One of the things with Asperger's, which is a form of autism, is you can have a really long span of attention. And you know, if you can't work 6 hours a day with a span of attention, you can't write.
So it tends to make one prolific. One other question, and we're just about finished here. You've spent many years as a screenwriter, which is a unique. I mean, I've had several screenwriters on this show who also, like Stephen Harrigan, where we talked about, who also were novelists, and talked about the effect that maybe writing screenplays has on how you write fiction. So turn that into a question there.
You have to learn to think visually. And I think that's why the screenwriting makes me able to put you in the cockpit.
Without the dangers.
Yeah, without the dangers.
Okay. Tell me, we got a minute. Tell me what you're working on now.
Oh, I'm just finishing a book about the year between the first raid on Wake Island and the fall of 43 and the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the biggest naval battle in history, which is the most successful naval campaign in history. It was the Navy that was built for World War II. And I've collected stories about the three leading groups and then the rest of them. And I haven't seen anybody put the entire campaign into one account before. Everybody's talked about Tarawa and this and that and the various battles, but putting it all into one context. It's called Pacific Thunder, and I'm hopefully going to write the end next week.
Okay, finally, 30 seconds. How does Asperger's affect you as a pilot?
It never affected me as a pilot.
A lot of concentration
One of the reasons why I don't fly now is I have what's called Meniere's syndrome, Meniere's disease, which really should be a syndrome because it isn't something you catch; it's something you have. It's buzzing in your ears.
Oh,
well,
wow.
It's a thing about a deterioration of the ear canal.
Yeah, not good. If you're flying,
I can stand on a solid surface and turn my head really quickly over my shoulder and fall down.
Okay, and we've got to leave it at that. So don't fall down now.
Okay.
Author and military aviation historian Thomas Cleaver, talking about the true story of Catch 22. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio.